Hi, this is David Wilk for Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. Today I'm interviewing Joseph Esposito. Hi, Joe. How are you?
How are you, David?
Joe, do you go by Joseph or Joe?
I go by Joe.
Okay. There is this other Joe Esposito I found when I was kind of looking for your blog. There's the famous Joe Esposito who worked for Elvis Presley.
I actually once was literally confused with him by an executive recruiter who asked me how I had gotten into digital media consulting after a life in rock and roll. And the only thing I can say is that someday you're going to see a tabloid headline that tells you that Elvis has returned from the dead. And if Elvis returns from the dead, I can only say to you that I'm going on the road again.
Right. Right, with him, I hope.
Yes. I mean, me and Elvis, like, you know, we're like that, you know.
So, in fact, what is your background in publishing that got you to where you are today?
My background in publishing, I was pursuing an academic career and really got a little bit tired of that. I started out in university press publishing, but then rapidly drifted into trade publishing in New York and did that for about 10 years. Became very interested in computers early on. This is the pre-PC world. Through that interest in computers, got involved with reference books. From reference books, I got involved with such companies as Merriam-Webster, Encyclopedia Britannica, and ultimately Internet Publishing. So it's been a fairly consistent flow for me from print to electronics, from the East Coast to the West Coast, and it's just taken me a little bit of time to get there.
So you're now in California and an independent practitioner.
I'm an independent practitioner. I'm based in Santa Cruz, California, on Monterey Bay, and I sit here and I consult with the SEALs on matters of strategic importance to digital communications.
Well, I think actually the SEALs and sometimes the whales may have something to tell us about digital communication.
In the sense that they're potentially extinct, I'm not sure.
Well, no, I was thinking more about the whales' language is kind of equally obtuse to humans as digital communication can be sometimes.
Well, you know, you're making in a very playful way, making a very interesting point where there's this tremendous gap between people who are inside the field and people who are outside the field about what is going on, how things are to be conducted. And there are a lot of common misapprehensions about the way the publishing world works, the way digital media works. Because of that, and because digital media touches everybody, even people who are not particularly interested in it. Because of that, there's some confusion, and it could, in fact, negatively influence social policy at times.
Well, I think you're right about that. I guess I'm sort of curious, too. Are you thinking, you know, about this, that there's two different kinds of digital divides. One is sort of sometimes comes up as the people who are talking about digital media are the privileged parts of the society that actually have access to a regular broadband connection and have multiple computers and kind of are able to use media in a different way than someone who has no access to the web and maybe has to go to the library to have access to a computer at all. But then there's a different digital divide, and that's the even within people the realm of people who are computer literate, there are many people who don't have any real consumption of digital media as part of their daily life. So which of those two do you mean?
Well, I'd say all of the above, but there's other divides as well. I mean, another divide is not just within our own society. It's on a global basis. We live in a world in the United States where we take for granted a certain degree of education, affluence, communications technology, governmental institutions that more or less work, but that's not true for most of the world. So if you I recall a story of Bill Gates traveling to Africa to talk about computers and was astounded that he found himself in a village where there was one electrical outlet in the entire village. That should give us pause as we start to think about the digital divide. But because I do live in Santa Cruz and we think about karma and consciousness here all the time, I want to point out that the great divide is the one that's in our own heads where we continually start to think about things in either-or terms. We think that something is print or it's electronic. We think that something is free or it's toll access. We think that something is a creative effort and something is not a creative effort. We get into these various kinds of binary distinctions, and generally speaking, these divides we have are divides of our mental categories rather than of the phenomena that we're trying to work with.
No, I think that's true. But how would you apply that to, you know, the kind of common thinking that goes on within, and I'm mostly thinking about within the book business or within the publishing industry, however broadly that may be defined. People are trying to think about the future and trying to understand what will happen as the book business evolves as a result of all of the mostly technology changes, but I would also argue that it's structural changes in the nature of distribution and retailing.
And let's say it's structural changes in the nature of the editorial product itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, so an example there would be something that you and I have talked about in another context, which is the whole idea of interstitial publishing, for example. And in interstitial publishing, you have a situation where people are working with mobile devices. And because of the convenience of a mobile device, they might have 5 or 10 minutes to read a text on a mobile device where they are otherwise unoccupied. You know, you're waiting online at the supermarket and you may be reading a couple paragraphs of a book from your iPhone or from your Android phone or something like that. Well, that's a whole different level of distribution that no one could even have imagined a few years ago. You then have the editorial change where the interstitial use of that content could be something even more interesting, where you actually start publishing material for interstitial use. So you'd start to develop, for example, texts that are relatively short in nature, perhaps fictions that have a reading span of 5 minutes, or chapters that have a reading span of 5 minutes.
Right. And actually, what was really interesting, I went to the ebook Media Bistro's ebook summit yesterday. One of the panels included Lisa Holton, who used to be at Scholastic and has started a business called Fourth Story Media,
mm-hmm.
and she talked about precisely that kind of consumption in her context, which is publishing for teen girls, basically. And what they've learned in the publishing process by putting things out there, they've learned what the audience is really interested in. And the what she described is virtually what you just described. It happens because so many of the girls are using social media on their phones, or they're in communication mode all the time, and they're participating with the content that she's publishing in precisely that way. I thought that was really interesting.
And I think you're also touching on an interesting theme here, which is a real difference between working with digital media and working with print media, and that is that the individual you just referenced is studying this user behavior and very quickly responding to it. It's very easy to build the feedback loops into digital media. If you have a website, you can track every mouse click, for example. And that is something an old-fashioned book publisher really didn't have much opportunity to observe. You would publish a book and you'd hope to see the reviews. You might get a few letters by first-class mail. But generally speaking, your communication was slow and cumbersome, and you had to make decisions in the absence of that kind of user or reader feedback. In the digital world, you could put a website up at 10 o'clock in the morning and decide by 2 o'clock in the afternoon to revamp the whole thing based upon where you see your actual users going, what they're clicking on, how they're following the process of going through the website. That's revolutionary aspect of digital media.
Right, and very difficult, I think, and this kind of gets into another theme that I think we wanted to talk about, and that is how do larger publishers with established businesses already in place, how do they adapt to what is essentially a completely different model of publishing that may have to exist side by side with what they already do, because they have to obviously earn revenue through their old business model at the same time as they're trying to transition to something radically different.
Well, this is clearly the topic that gets the most attention, whether in legacy media or in digital media. Certainly the blogosphere is filled with this topic. I think the first thing to be said is that There's nothing to say that the legacy media are necessarily going to survive the change, and there's nothing to say that they necessarily should. A biologist told me the interesting story that we all know that the mammals came about and took over the planet after the dinosaurs had died out. But the biologist pointed out to me that the dinosaurs were around a lot longer than the mammals have been. So who's to say which particular organism was more successful? It may be that while we are pounding on the head all of the legacy media publishers, you know, the Random Houses and the HarperCollinses of the world, for not doing more and more and more, it may be that they know exactly what they're doing, and they're not in a growth business, they're in a mature business, and that the nature of their changes and the natures of their innovations should be modest and calculated as opposed to revolutionary and disruptive. That's another possibility.
Right. In other words, their job is to protect their existing business in a period of no growth.
Yes, I probably wouldn't use the word protect myself. I don't think you'd say the middle-aged person that the middle-aged person is protecting what they've achieved. Rather, what you do is you move at a different pace and you have different kinds of perquisites and different set of ambitions. So if you're running a legacy media company, you might be much more interested in the reliable generation of cash. If you're doing a new media company, you might not be able to generate cash for years to come. You may be living off of equity financing.
Well, let me ask you a question specifically based on the news of this week in relation to that, and that is, I don't know whether it's possible actually for a business to stay in that mode. So Random House in this last week has somewhat famously now written a letter to most of the agents with whom it does business stating that it believes it has the electronic rights inherent in its contracts to books that it contracted to publish prior to the existence of any language directly relating to e-books and digital media. And so what I would say there is that, in a sense, the legacy publisher is not only trying to do what it does well, but also trying to establish a certain amount of turf in the potential that it, or you know, on the potential that it might be able to make some money doing something different.
Yes, well, you're absolutely correct. I would say that this particular thing, this particular brouhaha, is a tempest in a teapot. This is a contractual dispute. This is not a matter of the way the world should work. It's not a matter of philosophy or political science. But people are going to be looking at these contracts, and ultimately this is going to end up in the courtroom, and there are going to be some determinations made as to just what the contracts say. And because this is a society that is very good at educating lawyers, the discussion is going to be extensive, it's going to be expensive, and it's going to be unsatisfying in its outcome for some party. But I don't really regard this as being a major issue because it is a contract dispute. You know, this is not the same thing as, for example, Google's mass digitization project, which was not a contract dispute. That was a bigger thing. That is a question about the nature of copyright, the role of Congress, the nature of copyright law, the role of private enterprise in the academic library world, you know, much bigger abstract issues. Random House may win or may lose, or they may win on some books and lose on some books. But ultimately, we're dealing with contract law and not a big picture item here.
Well, that's a fair point. So you've written, I think, somewhat about your sense that legacy publishers need to, or maybe just are, going to become more involved in direct marketing. And maybe you could kind of talk a little bit about what your thinking is there.
Well, this is my shtick, if I may use my favorite word. I've been thinking about this for a very long time, and I can actually tell you that it dates back literally to December of 1985 when I first began thinking about this, because I became associated with the J.K. Lasser Tax Institute, which published self-help books on preparing for your income tax return. And J.K. Lasser had both a retail business and a direct mail business that had grown up on the back of the retail business. And after I analyzed this, I made the interesting discovery that although all of the interest on the part of the management was in the big numbers of the retail business, The fact of the matter is all the profit was coming through direct marketing. And that got me thinking that direct marketing was probably a more potent force than I had imagined before. That thought really took a different form later on when I got into the dictionary business. And the dictionary business is a brutal competitive business in the retail channel. And it became very, very clear to me that it didn't matter what product you created and or how good a product you created, the distribution channels could determine what products would ultimately get shelf display for consumers. And that troubled me quite a bit because it always, of course, was my hope that the best product will win regardless of what the distribution channel might have to say about that. So my interest in direct marketing is of long standing. I would say that it's very hard to build a direct marketing enterprise in the publishing world because of this peculiar problem, and that is that books don't cost enough. They don't cost enough to support the direct marketing overheads. But now you move to the world of the Internet, and you start to say, well, maybe we can have direct marketing at a lower cost. We don't have to ship books. We don't have to ship mailing pieces. Bits are free, of course. And we also have a way of identifying people through the Google search engine and other search mechanisms. So my view is that we're going to see a rather significant uptick in the amount of direct marketing of publishing materials aided and abetted by the web itself and Google in particular, and that more and more publishers will begin to sell books off of their own websites or in joint ventures with other publishers, and we're going to begin to see this become a bigger issue in the competitive environment where the publishers are trying to sell more things direct, and organizations like Barnes & Noble and Amazon will resist that.
Right, so you feel that there's a kind of tension point there that will evolve as a publisher evolves into a different form of mechanism, or as some publishers may grow to be those things, whereas other publishers may not. But clearly, then they collide with the traditional retailer model of the retail aggregator who goes wide and not necessarily deep, whereas a direct marketing publisher would go probably narrower and would go very deep.
I think that's exactly right. Our mutual friend Mike Shaskin talks about this all the time. This is the whole point of developing vertical product lines where you can go deep. And I think that's certainly the way more and more publishing is going to go. I'd add to this that it's once again not an either-or. It's not a question that you're either going to be a channel marketer or a direct marketer, although there will be some companies that do make that decision. It does seem to me that you're going to have a pluralistic environment. That is to say, you're going to have direct marketers who will find a certain customer base through those direct sales. But those products will also be available in channels because certain retail environments will be adding value to those products. And let's also point out that in the United States, you do not have retail price maintenance. Now, I think that's regrettable. I wish we did have retail price maintenance, but we don't. And what that means is that if Random House decides to sell books on a direct basis, whether in print form or electronic form, directly from their website, the probability is that those books will always be sold at a lower price at Amazon.com. So any direct marketing you do has to deal with the realities of the marketplace today, which is that books are sold in different environments with multiple price points.
And do you think that stratification is a positive or a negative for the development of this business?
Well, you know, this is, when you ask that kind of a question, I have to make a wisecrack, and I have to ask you, am I buying or am I selling? Is it a positive for whom? Well, in the end, and I'm not saying that this is true at every step of the way, but at the final step, there's only one market, and that's the return on capital. And this is the thing that a lot of people just seem not to understand, that if you cannot get a return on your investment, things don't happen, or at least they don't happen for very long. So when you say, is this a good thing or a bad thing, the metric there is, if you put a dollar in, can you take a dollar 10 out? If you can't, it's not going to happen very long. This is a harsh, amoral analysis about the way the economy works. But we'd all be publishing better books and finding more readers, and we'd all be a lot happier with the publishing environment if we understood that ultimately the only audience that one serves is the capital that is invested in the organization.
Although it is possible to turn that equation around and say that the only way to achieve a return on investment is to satisfy the actual customer, however that has to be done. Because if you can't sell it, there's no business.
Well, that's absolutely true. But you also can sell it and still have no business if you don't sell it properly.
Well, that's true. But it may, you know, the other part of this is that the ecosystem does seem to enable variability, as you described it. And I guess the question I asked was probably not phrased very clearly. I guess what I was thinking was, is the difficulty of the pricing variability falling on the publisher in terms of making it a challenge for the publisher to be able to figure out how to be successful in a really changeful environment?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and it's a very difficult challenge. I'm not sure there's a simple answer to that. Certainly, the multiple pricing opportunities that are out there create more questions than it creates answers. Certainly, anybody who tries to publish things in an arrogant fashion without respect or interest in the needs of readership and customers is not going to be very successful. It's also very fluid. We've been watching as there's a big controversy now about the so-called windowing strategy, where you publish a hardcover first at $25 or $30, and over a period of time, typically 6 months or a year, you then come out with a paperback at, say, $14. For certain titles, you may come out with a mass market paperback at a later date at $8 or $9, and so forth. You have all these different windows out there. And then the question is, what's the right price for the ebook? You know, is the ebook $25 with the hardcover, or is it $14 with the trade paperback? Does it come out at the same time as the hardcover or the paperback? Do you publish the ebook first in order to get some sense of demand before you go to press for your printed books, as a way of trying to get a better understanding of the true demand for your print books? There are a lot of different questions here, and I don't think that anybody could say that we have figured all these things out. It's a dynamic environment. And I think that people have to approach this environment with the sense that we're still operating in a classroom here. Of course, to hear people talk about this is not a classroom. There are people with very firm, set opinions about all of this who believe they figured out precisely the way this has to be. And I think that's really uncalled for.
No, I think you're right. I actually think the lesson of direct marketing, especially as it applies to this environment, is that you have to experiment and respond quickly to the data. And I think one of the things that I have observed that in the publishing business in general, there's less reliance on hard data and more reliance on opinion than in many other customer-facing businesses today.
Well, I think this is a function of the indirect basis of selling.
Yeah, I agree.
If you're sitting at Penguin, and if you're the publisher of the Penguin Press, which must be one of the nicest jobs in the publishing world that they could possibly have, you're sitting there and you publish your books, you talk to agents, you talk to authors, you publish your books, you send them into the channel. The books appear at Barnes & Noble and Borders, at independent bookstores. They appear on Amazon.com and Palace.com and so on. And then you ask yourself, with all of this activity of acquiring books, working with authors, selling books to Barnes & Noble and so forth, at what point have I actually spoken to the person who's read my book? Well, the answer is that channel distribution militates against customer knowledge. As a consequence, one of the virtues of direct marketing is that, in fact, it provides a feedback mechanism from those actual end users, those customers, to the publisher. And this is one of the advantages of direct marketing over channel marketing. I want to emphasize that I'm not for one minute proposing that direct marketing is going to obliterate channel marketing. I think it might have the potential of becoming 2 or 4, maybe 5% of the business over 5 or 8 years. It's not going to become 50% of the business. but it's going to be a growth channel, and it has some particular dynamics that are very interesting, including the possibility of getting real-time data from actual end users, which publishers sorely lack today.
Oh, I think that's really profound. Listen, I want to thank you so much for spending some time talking to me. This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks, and I've been talking today with Joe Esposito. Thanks, Joe. Take care.
Well, thank you. Bye now.